Hey everybody, what is up? Welcome to Season 2, Episode 1 of Teach Play Disc Golf, sponsored by OTB Discs, Squatch Disc Golf, Putt Confidently, and EA Sports Sacks. I'm your host, Antonio, and today, guys, I have a very special guest with me. We have Tai Rolatis on the show. Now, this is not the first time he's here. What is up, Tai? He first appeared in Season 1, Episode 32, and I'm so grateful to have you with me here today to kick off Season 2. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great, man. Yeah, very blessed. I'm just out and about. Had a bunch of errands I had to run today. Yeah, we got a round in today.
That's awesome.
Did some coaching sessions early this morning. Yeah, it's doing great.
That is awesome. Awesome to hear. Glad that you can be here. I know life is busy. And so let's go ahead and let's run through the outline for the show so that the listeners know exactly what to expect. So we're going to talk a little bit about my vision real quick for Gladiator Disc Golf, which is the main channel, and Teach Play Disc Golf, which is the podcast. I'm going to share just a few things I want you guys to know about of what you can expect from this channel this year. Then we are going to break down the backhand. That was actually Season 1, Episode 1's topic, and it's definitely becoming a theme, I think, for future seasons as well. Talking about the backhand, breaking it down, we're going to start with some common misconceptions. And these are things, guys, that it's not necessarily bad coaching, but just a lot of things that over the years, Tai and I have noticed a lot of beginners and even up to intermediate and advanced players do these particular things and we don't want to do them. So we're going to talk about some of those. Then we're going to get into the backhand throw, how to do it properly. We're going to look at each part of the body and how it is used in the throw. We're going to talk about some bioefficiencies. And then we're going to leave you with our favorite drills, okay? And that will be the show. So a little different, you know, than previous Teach Play Disc Golf episodes, but I am very, very excited. So without further ado, let's get into it. Alrighty, so for Gladiator Disc Golf / Teach Play Disc Golf, they're actually going to be working very, very closely this year. Obviously, it's all the same channel. It's all published on YouTube under Gladiator Disc Golf. The podcast is Teach Play Disc Golf on Spotify and Apple and wherever else you get your podcasts. But the two venues or the two medias are going to be working together, and I'm super excited. What I basically mean is that every week is going to be an alternating episode. So right now, we're filming episode one about the backhand. The week after this publishes, there will be an instructional video on the backhand. And so a lot of the stuff that you might hear from this episode and additional teaching of things that I want to include in the instructional video will be in that video the week after. And so you'll have 2 weeks back-to-back content, really nailing down whatever the topic is, whether it's the backhand, the forehand, putting, dynamic drills, whatever it might be. And then the week after will be another podcast episode with a new topic. And then the week after that, so week four, will be an instructional video on week three's podcast. And so, whereas last year we pumped out 38 podcast episodes, we're not going to probably have nearly that many. There's only 52 weeks in the year, and if it's half of that and we're already into March, we're looking at maybe somewhere between 15 and 20 podcast episodes. But in between all those episodes, there's going to be instructional content on Gladiator Disc Golf to give you some more hands-on learning and actual demonstrations to help you learn those skills. So I'm super, super excited to get into all of that content this year and really break some things down. I'm just so excited for that. It's going to be good for me. It's going to be great. I'm going to try to have a guest nearly every episode if I can get someone on. So I'm super excited about that. So enough of me talking about what we can expect. Let's go ahead, Tai, and let's break down some common misconceptions in the disc golf backhand throw. Sure. Okay, so I'm sure we've all heard a couple of different things, but the three things that I want to get your opinion on, Ty, and I'll say them all now, and then we'll go through them one at a time. Throwing with the arm, rotation, and then trying to throw hard and far. So let's go and talk about throwing with the arm. This is a big common misconception, and let's just dispel it for everyone and break it down here.
Sure. So I think there's two really important things that people got to realize, right? Like, you have people who try to optimize their arm to be a lot more like a whip. And we see guys on tour that have a way more in to out motion with their arm. Guys like Drew Gibson, Edgar Robinson, right? Who have this super whip-like arm as they're coming through. And it's a more, again, out and in motion. Creates really effortless spin. And if we look at any realm of athletics, spin creates optimal travel, right? So if we're creating a more whip-like state with our arm, we're going to get more effortless spin. But the motion is totally different than just trying to essentially do a reach where we use our arm on a very small plane. It's really fast, and then we pull it to get ahead of our body, right? I think the pitfall with throwing with your arm versus trying to create a whip is you never really get your upper body in a state of lag, right? Mm-hmm. Which lag only helps the whip become more optimal. So if we are actually using our bodies, right, we're going to fire our offside, and that's actually going to create we're going to fire this lower body, and that actually creates lag in the upper body. Mm-hmm. And so the arm actually technically never gets ahead of the body up until the full rotation happens. It's out in front of us. How it naturally should happen. But if we use our arms, then our arm actually gets ahead of our body.
Yeah.
We're getting into the pitfall where we're having to manufacture that out with our arm. And so the cool part about biomechanics is that if we do something correct from the ground up, it works itself out. So if we do one step correct, it helps the next step. So in my opinion, I think creating a more in to out motion and a more whip like arm helps create more effortless spin, but it also helps you inevitably get more distance because of that travel of our arm whipping through. So.
Definitely something thrown with the arm is I don't know that any beginner disc golfer has picked up a disc and not thrown with their arm, you know, because all those disc golfers that you just mentioned, you watch them throw and you're like, oh, look at how they throw with their arm. We perceive it to be that they are throwing with their arm. Obviously, as you get into the sport and you start to better understand the mechanics of throwing, you realize or you should learn from a good coach that, hey, ooh, they're not actually throwing with their arm. Their arm is following this path. So it's almost like an optical illusion, which I think is what throws a lot of people off. It's like, wait, we're throwing a frisbee or a disc. Old habits die hard, right? We're throwing a disc, okay? But we're not actually throwing with our arm. So it's just a very cool thing to think about, but it's very tricky. And you know, the in and out motion that you were talking about, a lot of players, there's a lot that do that, but I know that I've also seen a lot of players who kind of are just walking away from the disc, and that disc doesn't always move in and out. And so I love the idea of keeping the arm loose, and all of them are doing that, or especially throwing very far distances, but they all have their own adjustments and different like idiosyncrasies to their form because all of their bodies are different. And so they're doing with what works for them. And so, but the thing is, they're not throwing with the arm. Now you started touching on this a little bit there. Let's go ahead and let's talk a little bit about rotation. You know, a lot of times we're like, oh, we got to get spin on the disc. Well, that person thinks they now got to spin like a top, right? We got to get spin. And so the disc now starts to come behind you, especially on your X-step or even on your standstill. And that is what creates what we call rounding. Okay. So Ty, take it from there. How do we break this rotation, or why is rotation bad in this particular sense of the throw?
So rotation, when used properly, actually helps aid everything. right? But I think where a lot of people have the downfall or the pitfall of rotation is when they place the upper body in such a point where it's already kind of in a rounded state, and then when they go to round, the arm gets way too close to their body, right? Mm-hmm. So rotation actually helps create a lot of different great things. If we're talking about getting dense muscle fiber involved, these areas where we found across athletics that actually pack torque and get really effortless power involved, those areas are going to be the back leg and all the big chain muscles there. It's going to be your abdominals, your back muscles. And so rotation actually in my coaching is actually super important, where we're actually using these offsides, what we call offside, the back leg and the core, to actually get involved in the throw. It's actually what starts your throw. So as we go through our X-step progression, we kind of get the whole X-step. We're going to a place where both of our feet are metered and we're going to be coiled and extended, and we want to make sure we extend not fully away from ourselves but in a good clean place of extension, meaning we're making some space for the disc to travel through, but it's not too far wide and it's not too far in. And the rotation itself happens with the offside. The start of the throw happens with the back leg and the core. It works its way up the body. We're trying to create effortless torque that essentially moves through our body, right? So this back leg and the core, those are actually going to fire. And that's what causes this lag state, a very strong pro position that we see a lot of professionals get into. So rotation used properly works really good. Mm-hmm. I think the pitfall that I see with rotation is people don't rotate and fire. They weight shift too much. And so they'll get into a state where now we are moving this way and then trying to rotate. And you'll see a lot of times that people, when you get fully stacked on this front leg, no longer have a brace.
Right.
The brace is important to make sure that we actually transfer all that power that we just used into the implement. Just like baseball or discus throwing, all those sports have braces. Something out in front of you. So the brace should be structured out in front of us after we rotate, so that we were actually throwing against our leg, not on top of it.
Okay. Yeah, I totally see that. And it's different than throwing with the arm, but there is this fine line, I think, that you pointed out when talking about rotation, that it's, if the disc is coming behind you, obviously your torso, your spine has to rotate.
Yeah.
But a lot of the times is we think of rotation as how we're going to be throwing. And so that's where you start to see a lot of those rounding problems come into play. Whereas the way that you were talking about it had nothing to do with the upper body necessarily. It was more about how are we going to engage, like you said, those dense muscle fibers, those lower body mechanics, and for the hips to go from pointed away from the target to bringing the rest of your body to come and follow through towards the target. Something has to move, and that's through rotation there. So I totally understand what you're saying. I can see the differences there, and I appreciate you breaking some of that down. Now, this next one I think is going to be pretty easy for us because we've already kind of touched on it loosely. Trying to throw hard and far. A lot of times people do this one way, throwing with the arm. You know, there's a, he's not creating content as much anymore, or definitely not for dynamic disc, but Danny Lindahl, I think at this point pretty much is king of the phrase, was it slow is smooth and smooth is far? You know, that is something that I remember learning 6 years ago, how to play disc golf. I was watching tons of Danny Lindahl videos. And if you're trying to throw hard and far, the big mistake that a lot of people make is trying to do things fast and trying to do it hard. Oh, I got to do my X step harder. Oh, I got to pull this disc across my chest faster. And that's going to create speed. You were talking a little bit about some other sports there when talking about rotation. And what I want to ask you is, do we see in any sports where dense muscle, or not dense muscle, but rigid muscle, does that ever give us the ideal performance when we are really straining to do something in a sport?
Well, I'll take it from my background, right? And at least in discus throwing, one of my coaches was an Olympic coach. And some of the things that she would tell me is, you know, Tai, if you're just trying to muscle your throw, it's not going to go as far. We have to stay loose. We have to make sure that the body, especially the lower body, is getting ahead of the upper body, that way we're creating lag. And if we do proper mechanics from the ground up, everything structures and complexes itself the way it should. So it should be super simple. If you do something correct on one side, it should be correct on the other, right? And so I think it's super important to realize that if you start with the lower body and you keep things loose, even through the lower body, you know, you have this bounce to your run up, or you just kind of stay slow through everything, you set your body up in such a more athletic and powerful position to get more effortless power in distance. So if you're having issues in your form, I tend to tell people to actually slow down first and then progress. Look at the pitfalls of what's happening. Look at the inefficiencies of what you're doing, and then attack them, and then start to add speed. Because at least in my journey from discus to disc golf, two wildly different sports, but the concept still stays the same. Flow is smooth, and smooth as fuck.
One thing I love about that is we both tell people to slow down, go even slow down so much that you're not doing an X step, you're doing a standstill, and then start to work back into it. But when you go into your X step, you go slow. Slow things down, get the timing down because you want to get that muscle memory. Now, what's so funny to me about all of this is that my theory is that as people slow down, they're going to realize, huh, I don't actually have to speed up. I can throw 300, 350, 400, 450 feet or more, you know, depending on someone's skill level and talent and just natural gift for throwing the disc. They may say, hey, I can keep moving pretty slow and throw it pretty far. I know it's an anomaly. But look at Paul Ohman. I've been watching so much of GK Pro's disc golf coverage from the Tour Down Under. And Paul, I mean, I would not, you know, I'll be honest, I don't know that anybody should try to throw as slow as Paul Ohman because I've seen videos of people trying and it is hard because it's not natural to them. But that whole idea of there's this guy who is famous for being so slow. And yet, because the timing and the bioefficiencies that we're going to talk about in a little bit are all in place, and he creates that lag and he creates this cascading effect, whatever you want to call it, he goes and throws 450, 500 feet, however far it is. And then you have guys that are a lot quicker, like James Conrad, who's doing a full run-up and he's throwing, you know, 600 feet, 550 feet. It has less to do with all that speed and more to do about the comfort of them throwing along with their timing. And so I think it's great to start with slow because I also think it helps keep a person calm if they can establish a rhythm that way. And then if someone wants to speed up their rhythm, that's totally fine because they'll have the muscle memory and the mechanics that they need in order to do that. So awesome stuff. I'm so glad we tackled a lot of those misconceptions, throwing with the arm, aspects of rotation, and then trying to throw hard and far. If you are straining your muscle to do an athletic thing besides lifting weights, it's not going to be as efficient. You have to keep things smooth and elastic. There's a reason Tom Brady did stretching and yoga and all that and not hitting the gym to play 21 years in the NFL and throw the ball, you know, 30 times a game. All right. You got to keep things loose. So now let's go ahead and say, okay, those are all the things we don't want to do. What do we want to do? One thing I love, Tai Yi, about conversations with you is that we agree that it all starts from the ground up. So let's go ahead and together, let's talk about the feet, the legs, and the hips, what they need to be doing, how we can position them. We can get in as much detail as we want. So I'll let you go ahead and take it away from there. The lower body, feet, legs, hips, what should we be doing?
Cool. So from my coaching, we have four, what I would say, simple, very, very simple foundations that we want to make sure we're hitting, right? So I'll back up a little bit, speak up a little bit more. That way you guys can hear me. But simply, again, everything's from the ground up, right? So we want to make sure that I'm going to essentially model everything in a stand. That way people at home, this is super tangible. Go home and start practicing these things right away. But again, as a disclaimer, because I think it's really important in the coaching world to make sure we tell people this, is that if you have any issues with mobility, flexibility, or athleticism, don't push yourself past that safe point. There's no reason to try to injure yourself in any sport or athletic. If you have all three things very healthy for you, mobility, flexibility, athleticism, you can push yourself. But don't go past that range. There's no way to put yourself that hard. So again, in my coaching thought, we have four foundations. One starts with the feet, because everything works ground up. We want to make sure our feet are staying exactly mirrored to each other, kind of like a basketball stance, right? Or golf swing, but then our feet are outside of shoulder width. We want to make sure that they stay aligned so that we have really good lateral movement. The minute I go heel toe staggered, I limit that movement, and it's more diagonal at this point. So it's really tough to have any type of lateral shift, or what a lot of people talk about in disc golf is rotation, weight shift. It's really hard to have either one in a heel toe staggered stance. We have great push movement this way, but not great this way if we're in a heel toe. So foundation one's all about athleticism. So mirrored feet, bent knees, or staying athletic. That's foundation one. Foundation two is we load onto our back legs so we get those dense muscle fiber groups involved. And then we coil with our core, so we're getting the obliques from the rear. And we're also getting these abdominals to actually get involved as well, because they're very dense muscle fiber, big chain muscle groups that should be used in the throw. So we're going to load and coil with those two in mind. Our third foundation is extension. That's clean, like I kind of mentioned before.
Right.
And offside engagement, where we're firing this offside. The last foundation, and arguably, if you do the foundations before a little bit off, I would say this foundation is super key to making sure that everything transfers into your throw. Brace leg integrity, which causes a natural follow through. If you ever notice people that throw super fast and they kind of weight shift everything before they rotate, everything happens to be on the front leg. And so they have to kind of force their follow through. They do this super exaggerated follow through. But if people that actually brace properly and this leg is out in front of them and it's structured, you'll notice that their follow through is not super exaggerated. But it's because all the energy, or the massive majority of the energy, is going into this and not being left in the body. Yeah. So, just to run it back real fast, foundation, all about athleticism. Let's get those feet exactly mirrored to each other, outside of shoulder width, and bent knees. Foundation two, we load and coil, get dense muscle fiber involved. Foundation three is we extend the arm. That way it's out in front of us and not rounded. And we also rotate the offside of the body and fire it through the body. Mm-hmm. And then three is we hold this brace leg until after release, and then that causes a natural follow through.
I love that. Yeah, I was just working with the student when we were talking about the feet, you know, how to do it, where to set them up. And, you know, I have a basketball background, and telling him that, hey, when you take your feet, you know, for those who are watching, basically side by side. And if you just end up tilting your toes away from the target a little bit, all of a sudden you have what a lot of people see to be the heel and the toe, the heel of the front foot of your plant foot and the toe of your back foot, creating this sort of gap that we always want to have in between our legs. But the hips are square, the hips are aligned, and they're not staggered off. I remember you and I several months ago talked about this, and it was so enlightening for me because it made so much more sense than having one foot forcibly out in front of the other. And so I think that right there is so important, whether they're completely perpendicular to the target or even pointed away a little bit, as long as those hips and feet are together in the sense of pointing in the same direction, that's going to give your legs and your hips that optimal movement that we are looking for. Now, I do have a question, and this is something I've actually been wanting to ask you. You touched on it there about the brace foot not spinning on the heel, basically, or on the ball of your feet, however a person might rotate on their brace, until after the throw. So one thing I'm wondering is, what kind of stress does that put on that brace leg when it's not allowed to, because it's having to obviously hold all this momentum that's come from the back of our body forward? Does that put any unnecessary strain, or is that ideal for how our body transfers energy?
Yeah, I think you just hit it on the spot there, right, with the second phrase that you put there. So again, the cool part about biomechanics, right, is that when you structure and complex things properly, it inevitably transfers very efficiently. So let's break that down super fast, right? If a brace leg is structured and complexed out in front of us, where is the energy going to go, right?
Right.
Because we threw all this torque into our body, but since I held this brace strong, so right when the disc releases, it goes into the disc. So right. What is left inside of our bodies to put strain on this leg? Hardly any, right? The cool part is when your brace leg is structured out in front of you, it's in a very strong position, right? Where our heel and our knee and our hip are all aligned in different places, but the bone and tendon structure is all complex out in front. Okay. So it's really strong. I tell people all the time, when you're trying to create when you're trying to manufacture a brace by falling on top of it, you've now created a beam. Right. And a beam, if you try to essentially throw against it, it doesn't work very efficient. So it topples or has to rotate, right? So obviously, again, in the world of coaching, we have to be very careful with telling people this or that is going to make things always better, right? There's injury prevention that has to be mentioned. But again, if you're really healthy with mobility, flexibility, and athleticism, the level of torque that your body is going to be able to handle is going to be different from somebody who has an issue or inefficiency in one of those areas. So I would say always make sure to judge yourself accordingly.
Right.
But for the most part, if you don't create enough torque, you don't technically have to follow through, or you won't naturally follow through and it won't hurt you. So
gotcha.
Okay. Brace leg is super, super important in transferring energy efficiently.
Awesome. Thank you for breaking that down. Because that was something I've wondered about, especially when I see you throw. I'm like, because I know we've talked a little bit about that heel. Now, something that I'm wondering as well, because I've been trying to figure out, is this what's maybe causing some discomfort in my knee or not? Because you talk about being in an athletic position, does that knee need to stay bent even on the brace and the follow through? Or I know guys like Simon straighten their leg out. So, and I also know from years ago, I think like Seabass22 talking about like crushing the can. So you got that bend and then it becomes straight. And so, you know, there's all these videos of pro disc golfers doing it differently. Is it more about preference, or is there clearly like, hey, do it this way, this will be better? What do you think?
I think every body type is slightly different, right? So some people's tendons and muscle structure can handle more than others.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking, I don't teach anybody to get in a position where they're in the realm of hyperextension, right? Where we're fully locking out movement or joints, fully locking out tendons, muscle structure. In my coaching thought, there should always be slight bend, right? That way things are staying super, they're still staying structured, complex, right. And they have strength, right?
There's no makes sense to me,
right? To get in the position, this leg fully locks out and hyperextending and putting undue stress on this knee, whereas I could avoid much of that by keeping it bent slightly, right?
Okay. Kind of
the same thing that we see in disc golf right now with people dealing with elbow and like tendonite or tennis elbow, right? Is that they are fully locking out their arms and it puts stress on their elbow. You should have a athletic bend just about every bend point of your body when you're throwing the disc. So my arm never fully gets super locked out. I still keep things slightly bent, making sure that you stress there.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. You know, staying in an athletic position, I know, is something that, regardless of the sport, coaches are always teaching, be athletic, stay athletic. And if any joint is fully open, so to speak, like that elbow being fully open, it's not in an athletic position. So one of the things you talk about there with the upper, with the throwing arm, is that made me think of someone who's not on tour anymore, but is one of the best backhand throwers I think we've seen in several years, is Seppo Paju. And Seppo has a loose throwing arm. You see, even, you know, definitely more so than you, but you actually still see it. Like, his elbow is visibly not straight when he is coiling back. Like, he keeps that pretty close to him, and that coil is really nice and tight. So definitely a lot of great things to be working on here with the lower body, and I'm super excited for that to move us into the next part of the body that I want us to talk about. You mentioned earlier the, I don't know if you use these exact words, but sort of the off-arm or off-body side, the off-throwing side. So the off-arm, and then the backs, the core and the shoulders. Like, well, we won't get to shoulders yet. Let's just talk about this off-arm, our back, and our core a little bit. You already mentioned that, but let's revisit it real quick.
Yeah.
This, I think, was part of phase three. I think you said the extension biomechanics, bioefficiencies. How do these things need to work together following what the lower body has just done?
Yeah. So if you look in somebody like Eagle McMahon or Paul, right, Paul Macbeth, in their form, they create a tremendous amount of lag. And how they do it is they actually allow their lower bodies to be in a state that is going faster than their upper body. What does this do in driving efficiency into your throw? It helps your upper body to essentially play catch up, right? Mm. Where the whip is becoming more of a whip, right? You're getting more spin into the disc. These muscle fiber groups have transferred all of this energy through the body, and your upper body is still trying to get to that last point. So when you fire it is super important for timing, but because you're firing these offsides, you're getting all of that dense muscle fiber involved in an efficient manner. So I think it's super important to realize that when we get to the max amount of extension, right, where our arm is kind of getting away from ourselves and it's met max, not hyperextended, but right, it's at that really solid position. This is when we need to fire the lower body. The back leg, the core, and this off arm need to fire. That causes the lower body to get ahead of the upper body. It gets the dense muscle fiber involved, and it starts the throw in so much of a better structured and complex position. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Can you say that one more time? Because I really want everybody to just hit that home. You don't have to demonstrate again, but if you could just say what the timing is supposed to be again, because it's super important.
Yeah. So again, in Foundation 3, we have extension and offside engagement. We're going to fully extend our arm, right, to where it's slightly off of our body. And then as soon as this meets max extension, we fire, we go, right? And it doesn't, in the beginning, when you're trying to learn this, it doesn't have to be super, super fast. It just needs to be timed properly. And you will start to notice how much more effortless power is involved. But it's because we get dense muscle fiber involved. We rotated it at a proper time, and it transfers through the body because it structures itself well. So again, really simple. We extend our arm to just outside of our body, and then we fire.
I love that. Great timing. And you know, that is kind of like a marker for us to know, okay, when do we start this? Well, it's not some obscure moment in time. It is when we've reached that extension. And the thing, guys, that's going to be so helpful for all that is when that extension happens in phase three, timing, we want it to be as closely as possible. But when you start doing your X step, when that brace foot, that plant foot is coming down on your X step, that extension, that timing should be happening pretty close together. And so in the standstill, it might feel a little awkward at first, but as you develop it into the X step, that timing of planting that foot and that extension is what a lot of people talk about, sort of like getting this rubber band effect of fully, sort, quote unquote, being stretched out to now being compact. And that's what we're talking about here by having that extension be the initiator for that coiling and that initiation of the hips and the throw and that rotation in the lower body to create that lag effect. So super, super, super important having these sort of, you know, markers and biomechanics in our mind. So, all right, man, last few parts. I want to talk about, we've already talked about the throwing arm, I think, a lot today, and I think we understand. Do not actually use your arm to throw, especially in the beginning stages. You know, we can, there's another time and place to talk about, okay, when you're trying to throw a little bit further, there are some theories out there about still using some aspect of the arm, but I don't want to get there today. I want us to just know, hey, let's keep this arm loose, obviously controlled. It shouldn't be down by our side. We want it controlled, supported, but we want to keep it loose. The last part I want to talk about is our shoulders and our heads. Where do they need to be? What do we need to be doing with them to finish up this backhand throw?
Yeah, so my personal coaching thought with shoulders is that your shoulders don't pack a ton of punch, right? And especially for guys that are in your world right now, Antonio, who are dealing with shoulder injuries. We see a ton of them on tour. We see a ton of casual players. We see a ton of amateurs deal with some type of shoulder injury. And it's primarily from, at least mechanic-wise, from getting the arm in such a state where it's way too ahead of ourselves and we're overdoing or hyperextending that joint. The rotator cuff, the actual muscle and tendon structure that's around the shoulder, we need to make sure that we're complexing it well, but we're also not taxing it, right? And so I always tell people, if you coil with your core versus coiling with your hips or your shoulders, your body will naturally align itself how it should, right? So it's the nice thing, again, in biomechanics is if we do one movement correct, we don't necessarily have to do an undue movement or something extra. So I really emphasize coiling with the core versus coiling with your shoulders and having to just turn them, because one, it's way more efficient to coil with your core. You get dense muscle fiber involved, but then through the whole chain of the body, it will structure itself properly.
Yeah. Now, granted, to be fair, I think a lot of my shoulder issues come from an accident. We mentioned this in the class in session. If you guys want to check that out, it's on YouTube and on Spotify. But basically, I was in an accident 10 years ago, and I've just had chronic shoulder issues. But to your point, I have dealt with rotating that shoulder back way too fast, which has not helped the injury that I sustained 10 years ago. So it's compounded over the years. to where I already had a bad shoulder. And then I started doing this where instead of my core was following my shoulders instead of the other way around. And yeah. So that is where a lot of bad habits and things that I'm, you know, it's hard to break, but, you know, hitting myself with the disc because I get the disc on the right plane, but instead of allowing my core to bring it through and then my shoulders to stay stationary, my shoulders popping back. So now all of a sudden the disc is coming into me. And even when I'm just sitting here in a chair, I can feel that strain just by doing it incorrectly. And so if you're feeling shoulder pain, if you're hitting your chest with the disc, there's among other things, check out your shoulders. Do a slow motion video. Look at, is the shoulder pulling that arm across your body early? Because really the shoulder is not supposed to be pulling the arm whatsoever. But when you're doing it incorrectly, you're going to see the shoulder pulling that arm across the body to where the disc is too far ahead way too soon and not creating that lag. Which brings us to another aspect. And this is something that Cade Capps, who was on the show for an episode or two last season, has worked with me. And I'm really happy with where I've gotten at with this. Still need to always improve, but the head. We throw where our eyes are, but we also can over-exaggerate and accelerate by using our head too soon. And what I mean by that is one thing I've experienced is getting in the X step, the standstill, whatever it is. And as I'm coming into my follow through, what happens? My head pops forward because I'm looking down the fairway. And so I actually don't see the disc in the power pocket and I see the disc leave my hand. In theory, it's like, oh, you're looking where you're throwing. But what's happened is if your head is looking forward and you're just sitting in a chair doing it, that shoulder starts to move back because the way your body moves is it follows the head. And so if your head looks down the fairway too early, you're going to mess up your throw and you're going to cause unnecessary pain and injury on your shoulder. So one thing that I have worked on, because it's been hard for me, I spent years whipping my head around, and it is, whether I'm lining up a standstill or lining up my X step, is just, keep that spine straight, keep it flush. Don't think about moving your head this is something that helped me, is I don't even think about looking back at my disc. I trust my peripherals. I pick a point like, okay, that leaf right over there, that's where I am looking the entire time, and just allowing all this energy to move through my body, move through. And then as I follow through, my back shoulder comes and everything comes forward, and then I look. And in theory, what this is supposed to do, guys, is when that head turns around, the disc is already out into the fairway. And so we've had this clean throwing lane come across our chest from extension to follow through. And by not moving our head, we've kept things clean in that space, that power pocket that we need. And then we can see the flight down the fairway. Now, that was, my experience, teachings that I've implemented. Is there anything you would like to add to that, Taiyi? Some of your thoughts on what our head should be doing?
Yeah, so being that the head is like technically the top point of our throw, right? But we don't necessarily use neck muscles, obviously, in the throw, right? So I try to tell people, just try to keep things as natural as possible. If your head is comfortable, not to call people out, but you have guys like Jared, I'm pretty sure it's Jared Stoll, who lives out of Florida area. His head is fully looking back as he extends, right? But it's super comfortable for him. We've actually had a conversation before where he talked about how it felt like it opened up his coil a little bit more. So it was an interesting way to think about it. But I think wherever your head naturally
fits really well without getting too far ahead of your body, keep it there. There's no reason to essentially structure the head in an uncomfortable place. Like, if I know a lot of people talked about like this chin fist to shoulder where trying to keep a space there. I've heard people try to say keep the head really close to the shoulder. I've even heard people just say don't move the head at all, right? Yeah. But I think just align the head with wherever your spine is, wherever that naturally is fitting comfortable, and allow your head to rotate after the throw is done. I think that's where you and I agree, is where we want to make sure the upper body is getting ahead of ourselves, and then we can look at it. They say it in ball golf, and I grew up with a father who was a very, very phenomenal ball golfer, but he says, he used to always tell me, Ty, you need to hit a good shot, not watch a good shot. So I think it's like the same thing here in disc golf. We need to throw the shot and not watch the shot. The result will speak for itself. So,
ooh, I like that. I think that might be going on the thumbnail.
I love it.
Throw a good shot, don't watch it. I got to find a way to shorten it. Throw it, don't watch it. Something like that. Yeah. I love that. Yeah, and you're 100% right. Like, for me, telling myself, like, hey, we're keeping our head right here, especially on a standstill, that is something that works for me. But the principle at the end of the day, and you touched on this as well, is doesn't matter where, if you're looking backwards, you know, 45 degrees or 90 degrees, you know, adjacent to the target, just as long as that head does not come forward too soon, it doesn't matter. You know, it's allowing that, allowing all the other components that we've talked about take place first, and then looking and watching the throw. Feels weird. It definitely feels weird, because it feels like, how am I gonna hit my target? Well, it's all in the setup. It's all in how you've lined up to your target, to the gap. It's all in the mechanics, the bioefficiencies that we talked about, and hitting those things in sequential order the way they need to. And like a machine, in a sense, when all those things happen time and time again, and you've lined yourself up and you've learned how you throw and how the disc comes out of your hand, you're able to line up your shot to where you can be looking down the fairway as you're stepping up, and then as you start to do phase three, that extension, looking away and trusting that the disc is going to go where you've been aiming the entire time. And that just takes practice and familiarity. Speaking of practice, I want us to wrap up here talking about some drills, okay? So what are some things, okay, we've told everybody, here are misconceptions, here's what you need to be doing. How can we take them, Ty, from these misconceptions to what they need to be doing, to the ideal disc golf form in their own way? Because there's a lot of variation with the ideal disc golf form. So let's have you share one of your favorite drills, and I'll share one of my favorite drills. So go ahead, Ty.
Yeah, so I think, honestly, a lot of back leg stability is super crucial in disc golf. So I think a lot of like one-legged drills is actually super helpful, where we're balancing on one leg and we're kind of drifting into that plant leg, touching down and then firing. Mm-hmm. I think a drill that's catered towards balancing and building structure on one leg is super, super helpful. So it's called the balance and drift drill. You're essentially going to stand with both your feet together, then you're going to pick up your front leg, whether you are, then that's why I'm saying it, whether you're right-handed or left-handed, you can do it either way. Right. But whichever your plant leg is, you're going to pick that up off the ground. You're going to stand on that one leg for 2 to 5 seconds, and then drift into your plant leg position, and then fire and throw. Really, really simple drill, but it really helps with building back leg stability. It helps position your body properly. Then it's also going to inevitably help all the things up the chain work really, really well. So,
yeah, I love that. I've done a drill similar like that. I think when I was working with Cade, we called it like ice skating drill or something, like going from that one foot to the other. And it's the same principle. And I love that. And I think it's a great way to practice getting that brace leg down and actually feeling what it's like to have a brace and not be falling over something like that beam idea that we were talking about, actually having something there to hold it, I think is great. You know, one thing that is actually very closely related to that is something that I've mentioned before, and I made a video on it at this point a couple years ago called the gliding drill. We talked a little bit about that athletic position with basketball specifically, you mentioned, and just when you look at any baseball player, volleyball, basketball, even football in some instances, their mass is always between their feet, which relates to this plant leg and this brace happening. You never want that mass coming out and over, because then you lose control and then you lose all that momentum. So one of my favorite things is just getting warmed up with this gliding drill, which is in essence just sort of almost pretending you're doing, you know, a simple crossover in basketball, and you're shifting with both feet on the ground, whereas yours is one foot on the ground and then you come into the other. A variation of that is this gliding drill where your both feet are on the ground and you're keeping that mass, your center of gravity in between your feet, and just feeling the shift that your body experiences in that time. And so it is one of my favorites, and definitely I think tied with everything that you just shared in your drill, something that is super helpful. And I just find it hilarious that we both picked literal foundational lower body drills, because, well, we don't throw with our arm. So if you guys take nothing from this, start with the lower body, start with everything happening from the ground up. Don't throw with your arm, because that's where a lot of problems are going to come from. So if you guys need help with this skill and you're in the Middle Tennessee area, or you're just a subscriber of this channel and follower of the podcast, you can DM me on Instagram to schedule a free coaching call, which we can do on Discord. And if you're in the Pacific Northwest, please reach out to Tai for in-person lessons. He is a great coach and somebody that I have learned a lot from. And so also, if you want to learn from him and you're not in the Pacific Northwest, check out Optimal Disc Golf Coaching on Instagram. And Tai, is there anything else that you want to say before we sign off here for the listeners? Well, we're having some technical difficulties here at the end, so I'll just go ahead and wrap us up. To reiterate, if you're in the Pacific Northwest and you want an in-person lesson with Tai, go ahead and reach out to him on social media. Also, check out Optimal Disc Golf Coaching. It's his coaching page on Instagram. A lot of great content there. So that is all that we have for you today, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to Teach Play Disc Golf, Season 2, Episode 1. I want you guys to have a great round this week. Remember to teach somebody how to play. Be an encouragement to them. Make sure you play disc golf. And never forget, have a great round.